sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Dara Jeffries, discussing the remarkable movie Sfarad, the film, about Porto, Portugal. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Shinchinim, our young representatives of Israel, Shai Friedwald and Danielle Levy, and our Mavina on Israel, Imbash Stevie. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. It is my very sincere conviction that Judaism, properly experienced, is an incredible way to enhance life, adding deep meaning, spirituality, intellectual stimulation, ethics, and great joy to each of our lives. It's always fascinating to me how many American Jews don't realize how great our own religious tradition is, how much beauty and excellence it adds to what can otherwise be our rather pedestrian existence. Part of the pleasure of creating and recording this weekly radio show here on Two Jewish is that I have the opportunity to explore pretty much anything and everything about our religion and culture every 7 days. And somehow, having done this for 17 years, there's always something new and fascinating to discover still. That's partly because we Jews have been around for, 3,800 years or so, and have lived and had active Jewish communities in essentially every country on the planet at one time or another. That diversity is a wonderful strength, expressed in Jewish prayer, thought, music, food, art, clothing, even in temperament. And I love exploring the incredible range of Jewish life across the world, including the remarkable story we'll hear today of a Sephardic Portuguese community that preserved a secret Jewish identity for 500 years. Amazing. We must also note that the remarkable range of experience that the great storehouse of Jewish life makes available to us is balanced by powerful, shared, common elements of identity and character. For we Jews, no matter how divergent our backgrounds, share many values: a deep dedication to family, a reverence for the importance of education and learning, a profound connection to the land of Israel, a vital commitment to the greater notion of Klal Yisrael, the great shared peoplehood of all Jews everywhere. We are deeply committed to the greatest of Jewish ideals, the concept of justice, preserving it, seeking to see it in action in our world. We give tzedakah, the charity that goes towards righting the wrongs we see, and we work to help the downtrodden and needy in our civilizations, whichever ones we're in. We, nearly all of us, relate in very special ways to the wonderful, deep, fabulous Jewish holidays, and almost all of us celebrate a Passover Seder or light Hanukkah menorahs or come to hear the shofar on Rosh Hashanah. And even when we celebrate the Sabbath to different degrees and in very different ways, we retain an understanding of the meaning, beauty, and purpose of this incredible Jewish invention, a day of rest and sanctity, of family, food, and song. It's not simple to explain what Judaism is or why it unifies us through all of our amazing diversity, but it is a combination of these things, really, that connect us and help us fulfill the great Jewish goal of seeking to perfect the world under God's rule, L'takein olam b'malchut Shaddai. And this world clearly needs some fixing, no? It's perhaps not a surprise that I personally cannot truly imagine Jews choosing to live life outside the realm of a supremely accessible religious tradition that inspires us to seek so many great ideals, and does so by insisting we create practical means to make those ideals real in our own lives each day. Now, of course, I'm a rabbi and therefore somewhat biased towards appreciating the wonders of Judaism and living out those ideals in my own life and encouraging everyone to do so in his or her own life as well. But in America, in which there are so many incredible ways to experience high-quality Jewish prayer, study, social action, music, food, humor, among many other Jewish possibilities, I'd say that it's incumbent upon every American Jew to take advantage of the amazing things that are offered at my own synagogue, Congregation Beit Simcha, of course, but also throughout our community and in every active Jewish community. In this year, 2019, as it works its way towards its end, Judaism continually offers hope, energy, beauty, and meaning, as well as creativity, idealism, and joy. What more could any of us want? Well, on the subject of both joy and diversity, and to play us in this morning, here's Aaron Ben-Susan's fantastic, upbeat, energetic, and lovely Lecha Dodi in neo-Moroccan style. Lecha Dodi Likra
Let's go.
That was Aaron Ben-Susan's fabulous Lecha Dodi, a favorite setting of the great Song of Welcome for the Shabbat Bride. Our guest this morning, Dara Jeffries, is a member of the remarkable Jewish community of Porto, Portugal. She is here discussing the movie Sfarad, the film, which is about Porto. Meet her, hear this incredible story when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish a very special guest this morning. Dara Jeffries is an attorney and a member of the Porto Jewish community of Portugal and lives in Miami. It's a kind of a complicated story that's responsible for a remarkable project and a fascinating film, Sfarad. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
So tell us about the origin of this movie and maybe even step back even further. Tell us about the history of the Jewish community of Porto a bit.
Okay. So I guess you have to step quite far back.
Yes. Like, you know, 550 years or so.
Right, exactly. And so there was a time in Portugal and in Porto where the Jewish community was thriving and it was very well respected and liked and very well integrated in Portuguese society, got along very well with its, you know, other religions. And then there was an edict of expulsion in the sort of 15th century and 16th century. And the Jewish community basically was decimated because it either they fled for real, they went to Amsterdam, they went to many, many places, or they could stay. But if they stayed, they had to either convert or practice their religion in secret. So the practice of Judaism openly was very much quashed. And it stayed quashed for a very long time, and for the reason that the Inquisition stayed for a very long time. So the Portuguese Inquisition was not actually officially terminated until the 19th century. So Judaism was not really practiced, and there were very few Jews, really. But there were some, and some Jews stayed and some practiced in secret. But the Jewish community of Oporto really didn't come to be anything in particular until the start of the earliest 20th century. And at that time, there were various merchants, Ashkenazi mostly, actually, merchants living in Porto that had come from various other places, possibly escaping World War I, I'm not sure. And others had connections to the Lisbon community, which was a little bit larger and a little bit more established. And at this time, there was no organized community until about 1923. And at that time, the person that is really the star of this movie, Sfarad, is Captain Baros Basto, who had discovered his own Jewish origins and had converted formally to Judaism, decided to create an official Jewish community. So he did that together with the other Ashkenazi Jews that were living in Porto at the time and created the Jewish community. And but they had nowhere to practice. You know, they just had this, I think, go to some apartment and that sort of thing. And there were very few. And he then was found out that there were Jews that had been hiding in the mountains in Portugal for 500 years, basically. And this absolutely blew him away. He was absolutely fascinated by this and decided to go and find out about it. And, of course, at those times, going into the mountains, it wasn't so easy. They didn't have the great roads we have now. Thank you, European community, for our great roads to Portugal. But at that time, he had to go out by train and horseback and so on. It was quite a perilous mission. And so he did. He went around to all these communities and did discover these hidden Jews that were actually called Maranos. And these Maranos were, it was actually a derogatory term that was used at the time, were the descendants of Jews that had hidden from the Inquisition, you know, for all these centuries and had been discovered quite by accident. And so it became his mission that he thought he could rescue them, and that's what he literally called it, rescue them to the fold and bring them to the fold of Judaism, because they'd been so sort of separated from it that they were really practicing their own religion called Maronism, which was kind of a mix of Catholicism and Judaism and had been sort of handed down, you know, from mother to child and so on. And they'd been practicing it in secret. And so that was his mission, and he thought that he would build an enormous Jewish community in Porto. And he went about gathering funds from all over the world to build a synagogue in Porto that would be able to house this
giant new community. That,
correct, this potentially giant
community. Dara, we will continue with this fascinating and kind of amazing story, which led to the movie Sfarad about the Jewish community of Porto and the Jews of Portugal more broadly, when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this fall and winter. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson in the foothills and the fastest-growing synagogue in southern Arizona, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services both Friday and Saturday, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha is located at 7315 North Oracle Road, just north of Ina on the west side of Oracle. Services, classes, and events are open to all. Join us this Friday night, 7315 North Oracle Road, for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning Torah study with bagels and lox is at 9 a.m., followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Join us this Shabbat, 7315 North Oracle Road at Congregation Beit Simcha on the west side of Oracle, just north of Ina. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, and high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses, and of course all of our services, go to www.BeitSimchaTucson.org, that's BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675, that's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest growing synagogue community in southern Arizona during its exciting beginning years. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com, T-O-O-Jewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, streaming us from there, or downloading us at the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts, Top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about the Jewish communities of the Balkans, really a fascinating and very complicated subject. We covered, I think, both ancient times and then the Sephardic influx. Then you talked particularly about Thessaloniki, Salonika, that fascinating community. So it's fair to say that most of the Jews in the Balkans, besides that earlier origin group, were Sephardic Jews. Really up through Ottoman times, at least into the 19th century. What did something change at some point?
A lot of things changed. First of all, many of these countries gained their independence in 1878, and they were no longer part of the Ottoman Empire. Some then fell under the reign of the Austro-Hungarian monarchs.
Right?
And some countries became truly independent, like Bulgaria, parts of Greece, Serbia.
Of course, that helped lead to World War I, but that's a different subject.
Right, right. And this was all in a pretty condensed period of like 50 years, 70 years at most, much less than a century. And as this happened, Jews from other parts of the Austro-Hungarian Empire began to move into what had previously been Ottoman territory. So classic example is, you take Belgrade, which is a very ancient city, situated on a fortified promontory between the junction of two and ultimately three rivers, the Sava, the Drava, and the Danube. And they all meet at this very strategic point. So empires from ancient times always fought over who could rule Belgrade. Well, the frontier in relatively modern times was actually one of these rivers. And across a bridge from Belgrade, I mean, literally you could walk in 10 minutes, was the southeasternmost point of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. It's a like a suburb of Belgrade called Zemun. And what was interesting to me is that even 100 years after this happened, you could go to Zemun and find like an Austrian pastry shop or a Viennese cafe and feel like you were in Vienna. Whereas when you return to your apartment in Belgrade, where I once lived when I was working for the U.S. Embassy there, you definitely felt like you were in a former Ottoman place, if not still Ottoman, in terms of hospitality, in terms of what kind of coffee do people serve you?
Exactly that. What kind of pastries? Kind of coffee, right?
You get baklava and Turkish coffee in Belgrade. Right. In Zemun, you get a Wiener Melange and strudel.
Yeah, I mean, it's very like right across. Right.
It's very simple and very clear cut. So the Jewish community in Belgrade maintains still a very old cemetery that is slowly filling up. I'm not sure what they'll do when it is full. But when you visit that cemetery and you look at gravestones from the 19th century, you see that in the early part of the century, everybody had classic Sephardic names. And on some of the gravestones, there are photos which show guys wearing turbans or fezes and Ottoman beards and Ottoman robes. In the more recent ones from like the 1880s and 1890s, there are more names that we would consider recognizably Jewish, which means Ashkenazic, like Greenberg, Greenwald, Goldberg, whatever, and wearing Western clothes, Western hats, suits and ties, and without beards. So clearly this community made a visible transition in the latter part of the 19th century and became, at the very least, mixed Ashkenazic and Sephardic. And that brings us to the eve of World War I and ultimately the Holocaust, which changed the complexion of Balkan Jewry forever.
We can talk about that next week. Thanks so much, Tom.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Shin Shinim, our young representatives of Israel, representing the Weintraub Israel Center, Shai Friedwald and Daniel Levy. Boker Tov.
Boker Mitzuyan.
So American Jewish kids have some perceptions about Israel. Some of them, I'm sure, are correct. Some of them, I'm sure, are not so much on target. What's one area where you think some American Jewish kids don't really understand the reality of Israeli life?
I think a lot of that, for example, I will give one example. I went to a synagogue and then I helped two boys learn Hebrew. And then one of them told me, "Hey, Shai, are you working here? I didn't understand for all the point that you come here." And then the other boy said, "Hey, dude, he's going to college." So, yeah, they don't really understand.
Because their other teachers are college kids who are students at the University of Arizona or wherever.
Right, right. And their brothers and their family.
Right.
So they don't really get a perspective that all of the people going to the army, and then, like, they don't even think about college or
The college is 3 years down the road for guys, and how long for women? Like about 2 years?
2 years, more or less, yeah. Because for them, it's hard for them to accept that there's a different reality than what they're used to. I mean, we showed them, like, we did an activity about the army, and we showed them actual pictures of soldiers, and we're like, this is what we're are going to wear, and, like, have weapons on us 24/7, and go and fight, and walk thousands of miles, and carry like really heavy weight on us, and they just like don't really seem to connect it that it's something that's really going on and happening.
That these two people who are sitting in front of them, or one person who's teaching them Hebrew or talking about Israel, is going to be in the army in 9 months or something like that.
Yes.
Right.
In Israel, if you think about college, it's like a post-army experience, of course. What percentage of Israelis go to college, do you think?
I do think most of them do, because I feel like how we, like, live our lives, we just, like, go through everything, live our young life, go to the army, we just get all of that out of the way afterwards, and then we're, like, totally ready and grown up and mature enough to go to college and, like, actually know what we want to study for the rest of our life. Because with 18, I don't think someone's, like, really prepared to make that decision. So I feel like we're actually grown-ups with,
but
like,
they may not be, and it costs $75,000 a year at some of those colleges to not know what you're doing.
Absolutely. So, yeah. I mean, it's like worth of money, like a waste of money and time. Absolutely. Yeah. And I feel like with, I don't know, what depends on the person. If it's like 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, I think you should already know, like, what you like to do, what you're willing to do, what you're ready to sacrifice for. So
it's a very different perspective. Do you think that American Jewish kids can get that perspective? Can they really understand that?
I don't think they can.
Because I think just maybe if they will go to visit Israel and they will see, and maybe on birthright, but I think much younger age, they will go to Israel, they will see all the
They will see
kids,
soldiers everywhere.
Right, in our age,
that you're older, right.
are serving in the army instead of teaching them Hebrew or doing activities about Israel over here with them. Right. So I think that they will get another perspective.
Like, it's very interesting, and it's obviously, while there are many similarities between American Jewish kids and Israeli kids, this is a huge difference, and I think it changes everything at a certain point. Thanks so much. We will talk next week. Be'etraot.
For sure. Bye. Yalla bye.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. When the great physicist Albert Einstein was young, he was regularly invited to speak at various conferences. But the great Jewish physicist nearly always found himself wishing he was back in his laboratory, carrying out calculations, doing his pioneering work. One day, Einstein said to his chauffeur, "Look, Izzy, I'm tired of making all these speeches, but what can I do?" Izzy replied, "I have an idea, sir. I've heard you give that talk many times before. I'll bet I could quite easily give it for you. Now, why don't we go find a wig, and I can dress up like you and do the talk tonight?" And Einstein laughed and replied, "What a good idea, Izzy. Why not?" So, for the talk that night, they traded clothes. Izzy got a frizzy wig. Einstein put on Izzy's chauffeur uniform and cap and then got behind the wheel of the car. When they got to the hall, Einstein went and sat in the back row. Izzy went to the front. He didn't have to have worried about how Izzy would do. He gave Einstein's usual speech perfectly and got an ovation from the crowd. But then one of the professors asked Izzy an awkward question about the speed of light in relation to the formation of antimatter. And Izzy replied, "Oh, that answer to your question is so easy. In fact, it's so basic, I'll ask my chauffeur, who's sitting in the back of the hall, to answer it." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week, we read the portion of Chaye Sarah, which marks a transition in our Genesis narrative from the tales of Abraham and Sarah, our first Jewish father and mother, towards the next generation, featuring Isaac and Rebekah. But we first begin with an ending. At the start of the portion, we're told of the length of Sarah's life, and almost by accident, we learn that she has died. The life of Sarah was 100 years and 20 years and 7 years, our Sedra begins, and the famous Midrash tells us that Sarah was just as beautiful at the age of 100 as she was at 20, and just as free of sin at 20 as she had been at 7. It's a fine encomium for a significant figure who now passes from the scene. Chaye Sarah is a portion filled with negotiations that have great influence on the future of the fledgling religion, someday to be known as Judaism. The first extended section of Chaye Sarah is actually dedicated to arranging Sarah's funeral. Abraham purchases the cave of Machpelah in Hebron, first piece of real estate owned by our people in what will eventually be known as Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel. That cave becomes the burial place not only for Sarah, but for most of the patriarchs and matriarchs. Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Rebekah, Jacob, and Leah eventually all find their final resting place in Hebron. In Chaye Sarah, the purchase of this plot involves an extended bargaining session with the Hittite who owns it, the payment of a huge sum for the first permanently Jewish land in the world, establishing Jewish legitimacy in the Middle East at a very early point in history. I visited Machpelah a few times, once many years ago when you could go into the cave itself, and about 4 years ago when Jews were only permitted by the Israeli authorities to go into the area above the cave for fear of creating a violent incident. Still, it's a powerful place. After Sarah's burial, the narrative moves us forward with one last important detailed episode of Abraham's life. Abraham is now very old. He sees that his son Isaac has not married, and perhaps seems unlikely to do so without parental intervention. Abraham charges his trusted servant to go back to the old country of Sumeria, Haran, eastern Turkey, just north of today's Syria, and bring back a suitable girl for Isaac to marry, and so carry on the line of believers in the one true God. After a long journey and the first extended prayer we ever have in the Torah, the servant meets Rebecca. She is drawing water from the city well in Haran. He knows she's the one for Isaac because she shows great generosity and intelligence. The servant, too, bargains, in this case, with Rebecca's duplicitous father and brother. Eventually, this servant arranges for Rebecca to become Isaac's wife. But at the crucial moment of the narrative, Rebecca's family puts the question to her. Will you go with this man? That is, will she, Rebecca, leave all she has known and journey to an unknown land and to an unknown future husband? The final negotiation of Chaye Sarah is brief. Rebecca quickly agrees, yes, she will leave her homeland, her father's house, and go to the land that will be shown to her. Like Abraham before her, she embraces this call to begin a new life. And so she goes and meets Isaac, and the future of the people and of all monotheism is assured. These three negotiations revolve around crucial elements in our people's history: land, descendants, and destiny. Without title to the land of Israel, we would have remained homeless wanderers. Without descendants, we would have simply ceased to be. And without the courageous choice of women and men, like Rebecca and Abraham before her, our destiny would have been, well, not greatness, but disappearance. As Jews, these three things remain our principal goals today, and often they still require negotiation to achieve: a secure land of Israel, our children and grandchildren's Judaism, and the destiny of our people as a moral light to the nations. They are great goals, and we continue to work to achieve them. Our guest this morning, Dara Jeffries, continues the amazing story of the Jews of Porto and the new film Sfarad. Hear all about it when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
During his Veterans Day speech in New York last week, President Trump told the story of Master Sergeant Roddy Edmonds. It deserves retelling. Edmonds, who died in 1985, was a senior non-com officer in a German POW camp in 1944. When the camp commander ordered all the Jews to step forward, he refused to allow it. "We are all Jews," said Edmonds, who was not Jewish. Threatened with a gun, he said, "You can shoot me, but you'll have to shoot all of us. And when the war comes to an end, you'll be tried as a war criminal." The commandant turned and walked away. President Trump then pointed out that two people connected to Edmonds were in the audience: his granddaughter, Lauren Matthews, and former Staff Sergeant Lester Tanner, one of the Jewish soldiers saved by Edmonds. Tanner gave testimony that helped Edmonds get posthumously recognized by Israel's Yad Vashem Holocaust Memorial as a righteous Gentile among the nations. He was the first American soldier to receive the award. In the Middle East, Israel and Palestinian Islamic Jihad agreed to a ceasefire near the end of last week, putting a tentative end to several days of hostilities. Gaza factions launched massive rocket barrages at Israel for two straight days last week, indiscriminately firing hundreds of rockets towards civilian targets in Israel. That began the day after Israel assassinated a top Islamic Jihad commander, Baha Abu al-Atta. 31 Palestinians, including one Islamic Jihad field commander, were killed. At least 97 were wounded in those retaliatory Israeli strikes. As of the latest estimates, which are likely to go up, Israel's Iron Dome defense system intercepted 90% of the 300 rockets launched from Gaza. Those rockets were aimed as far north as Tel Aviv, shutting schools in central and southern Israel and forcing a million children to stay at home. Notably, in last week's conflict, it was not Hamas firing rockets at Israel, but Islamic Jihad, And Israel actually worked with Hamas to suppress the still more radical terrorists, Islamic Jihad. Iran banned the sale or purchase of books by the Israeli historian and author Yuval Noah Harari last week, saying they promote the theory of evolution and distort history. Yuval Noah Harari, a past guest of Two Jewish, is known for his bestseller Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, which charts the course of the development of humans from the prehistoric era all the way to modernity. The Tehran Publishers League, announced the ban. In May, Iran's cultural ministry barred the publication of all of Harari's books. Sapiens, which is, frankly, no less than one of the most interesting books of the past 10 years, was originally published in Hebrew as a text for Harari's students at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. It has been translated into 50 languages and is an international publishing sensation. Frankly, everybody should read it. It's great. And now it's banned in Iran, which I personally think is a kind of badge of honor, to be honest. Yuval Noah Harari is also the author of 21 Lessons for the 21st Century, Homo Deus, and Money, but Sapiens is really great. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews round the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Dara Jeffries is a member of the Jewish community of Porto. We began hearing the really fascinating story, not unusual to Jews who know about the expulsion of the Jews from Spain in 1492, from Portugal in 1496, but of this sort of hidden community in the mountains of Portugal that kept alive Judaism in a form for 500 years. It's an amazing story. So where we cut it off earlier in the show was he started raising funds to kind of build this new synagogue for this community that he believed was going to be reestablished. And maybe you can pick it up from there.
Yeah. So to me, that's possibly the most extraordinary feat, was that he did that. He was able to go all over. He went to London and pled his case, and they actually set up a Portuguese Maranos committee to support this project. He got funds from Hong Kong, from benefactors, and the synagogue was inaugurated, and it was really quite giant, in 1938. And that date is significant because, as you know, World War II broke out the following year, and Portugal itself was under a fascistic regime. It was incredible, if you think about the time when this took place, that he was able to build and inaugurate a synagogue at the start of World War II.
Incredible.
Under a fascist regime. So to me, that was really quite an extraordinary feat. But the timing was also very unfortunate because his mission, and I won't go into too much detail, but obviously his mission of rescuing the Maranos did not really pan out as he had planned. And then World War II broke out, and it wasn't an ideal time for that. But instead, the synagogue ended up...
Yeah, I mean, I don't mean to minimize it, but think about it. Yeah, let's start a really big synagogue when the Nazis are killing all the Jews of Europe, and Spain right. and Portugal are really kind of quiet allies, even if they're... I mean, just crazy time.
Crazy. No, it was really... I mean, when you think about it, it's really quite extraordinary. And he built it incredibly large because he wanted it to rival, you know, cathedrals. He thought that, you know, that people would be more prone, if they had sort of Catholic exposure, to something that was imposing and looked very magnificent, that they could be proud of.
Well, he might not have been wrong, but might not have been wrong about that.
No, exactly. And it is a beautiful, beautiful building, and it's beautifully decorated on the inside. He really went to great lengths to make it quite extraordinary. But so what happened was that during the Second World War, it became a haven for refugees, Jewish refugees, fleeing the Nazis. And he was a very meticulous man, and he kept meticulous records. And those records, in fact, we gave to the Holocaust Museum in D.C. because they were like little cards, you know, and it had the name of where the person and where they were coming from and where they were going. And, And really hundreds and hundreds of people passed through there and were given, you know, comfort and material comfort because they had nothing. And these people literally had nothing when they arrived. And Portugal wasn't a rich country at the time. It's not like they had a lot of money either, but they were safe. And that was interesting, too, because even though Portugal was a fascistic regime, once the Jews arrived in Portugal, they were safe. I mean, nobody did anything to them. And they were able to then take ships, and very few stayed. They basically were planning to go on to the United States or South America, and they sailed from Porto and went on to North America. But some did stay. I mean, a couple stayed. So the community grew a little bit from there. But the Murano part of it did not really happen at that time. Very few Muranos actually ended up joining the community at that time. And the captain himself ended up having all sorts of problems, which I won't go into too much, but suffice it to say he was like the Portuguese Dreyfus. You know, he was expelled from the army. He ended up having, right. You know, having a really, really hard time of it. And so the community itself tended to just tick along for a very long time and not have much of a life. There was always a community, but it was always a very small community for years. And really, it was only... at the beginning of this century that the community started to expand. And I think a big part of that was quite recently there's a new law of nationality that has encouraged, that has really recognized the errors of the past and is allowing descendants of the Jews that were expelled and
both in Spain and Portugal. I think the Spanish law ran out in around Rosh Hashanah this year. This past Rosh Hashanah. But I think the Portuguese law is still, I think it's still in place.
Yeah, I mean,
right?
the Portuguese law, it doesn't run out, which it makes no sense for the law to run out. Why would they do that? I mean, it's like, oh, you have a time limit to claim your heritage. So the Portuguese law does not run out. So that was the plan. The plan was that people could a lot of people have. And not some people have moved back. Actually, a lot of people have. But many haven't. I mean, many have done it just because they feel like it is a sense of their right, you know, like an injustice that has been repaired. And many people have claimed their citizenship just because they feel they have a right to it and that makes them happy, and not necessarily because they plan to move back. But the community has grown enormously for lots of reasons. That's one of them. The other reason is, I think, because Portugal in general is just doing very, very well. It's become a very popular place. And so people are rediscovering it and then rediscovering their Jewish roots. And Portugal has a lot of Jewish history all over it, you know, in many, many places. It's extraordinary how much there is. In many of these towns, you'll find, you know, remnants of, you know, either a Jewish ark or even an old synagogue. And so it people are discovering that and finding it quite interesting. And so the community itself has flourished.
Which is remarkable. Tell us a little bit about the film and the way it tells this story.
So the film, it's such a big story. It was very hard to capture so much time, you know. I mean, we literally go from the time of the expulsion to present day, focusing a lot on this period of the building of the synagogue and the founding of the community and all the tribulations that went around that and how hard it was for the captain to get people to be interested in this project of the Muranos. And people were very divided about it because on the one hand, they thought it was very interesting, but on the other hand, they thought, well, they're not really Jews and why are we doing this? And it's going to be such a huge, huge undertaking and it's not such a good time to be doing that. So this was his struggle, and so the movie really focuses a lot on his particular struggles about this. But there's a huge gap because we really just show a little bit of what Judaism was like, you know, in the 1400s and 1500s, and then it jumps to the 20th century. So that's a gap that we will be filling. I'll just say that. There's a new project underway.
Yeah, I of course. So you live in Florida, and yet you're a member of the Porto community. Explain kind of how that works.
Well, we were expat Americans living in Portugal many, many years. My parents moved there in 1969. And at that time, as is shown in the movie, there was a very small community. I mean, really very small. And I was one of the few Jewish people that lived there. I've been a member of that community literally since I was a child, since 1970, really. And so I've kind of accompanied its various stages in evolution. But at a certain point, we decided to move, myself and my husband and my family decided to move to the States. So we moved here a few years ago. But I'm still very involved with the community, and we go back maybe twice a year. And I help in various forms. But it was funny because growing up as an American and Jew in Porto in those days, we're talking about pre-revolution, because, you know, we had a revolution in 1974. I always felt I was like the representative of the whole Jewish community, you know, of the world of Jews. And I was always very, very conscious of this huge burden on me to behave incredibly well. I was an incredibly well-behaved child because I always felt that people would be like, oh, well, she's the Jewish one, you know. Mm. So I had to be very careful and always had to behave well because I felt like I was representing Jews.
Representing all of Judaism right met. There, yeah.
That's how I felt because, yeah. You know, very few people had ever even met a Jewish person, you know.
Sure.
So it was a strange time, and it's very nice to see, you know, how far we've come from that.
Tell me a little bit about how Jews are perceived in Portugal now. Obviously, you know, it's a complicated question, and there's no one answer, but...
Right.
I'm fascinated by
it. It is a complicated question because you'll always find anti-Semitism everywhere. But if you're going to be, if you're going to do it, let's say, in terms of contrast between Portugal and other European countries, I would say it's the least anti-Semitic of all of them. And generally speaking, I would say they're very pro-Jewish.
But you don't hear that a lot, do you?
You don't. It's unusual. And you'll speak to someone, they'll say, oh, yes, I have Jewish heritage. And, oh, I think my great-grandmother was, you know, they're quite proud of it. And they'll mention it. They'll say it. And a huge number of Portuguese people are descendants of Jews or have Jewish blood because so many, at the time, in Portugal, there was maybe a million at the time in the late 1400s and 1500s, it was maybe a population of a million people. And of those, maybe as many as 10% were Jewish.
Yeah.
So if you figure that a lot of them did stay and converted or, you know, whatever it is they did.
Well, you know, I've seen statistics that on the whole Iberian Peninsula, something like 30% of the people have some kind of Jewish DNA. You know,
I would say in Portugal, I would say it's even higher.
Wow.
I would think it's even higher. But yes, definitely at a minimum, that is true. And they seem to be quite proud of it. I mean, to be honest, I hate to say this, but I think it's because they've had such a low profile that people haven't had a chance to be anti-Semitic. And I don't know if now if we become much more populous and popular, whether that will change. So I don't know.
Yeah, you wonder if there'd been more Jews to relate to at a period when anti-Semitism was more ingrained in the culture and in the church, for that matter. If it would have been worse now instead of better. That's interesting.
That's right. And because we didn't have that presence and we had a very low profile and very low population, you know, that just didn't happen. I should tell you, though, the very important thing is that we have very, very good current relations with both the church and the Muslim community of Oporto. We've made a big strides and big effort to have excellent relations with them. And I think that's a very positive thing. And that's something we really do try and do is to try and make, we do have a lot of educational programs like for schools, you know, we do try and disseminate. And that's part of the reason for the movie. It's got an educational sort of purpose. And we do a lot of dissemination of Jewish culture and history through tours. And we built a museum so people can visit and learn about it because there was so little known, really. So that's a big part of what the community does, is a certain amount of outreach, you know, in terms of disseminating.
I think you should invite a rabbi who's also a cantor and has a radio show to come visit and help work with the community. Just
consider the invitation extended.
Okay, thank you. Where can people go to find out more about Porto? Where can they go to find out about the film about Sfarad? What's the best place for people to go?
I think there's a website. Sfarad itself has its own website. Actually, Randall can provide the details. I don't know the website offhand, but it does have its own website.
Right.
Then the community itself has its own website as well. It has a page, and they can look up Jewish Community of Porto, and they'll find it. And then in Porto in general, I don't know the website for the Porto tourism, but there's so much available out there right now.
I bet there's
now.
Not too many Porto, Portugal tourism websites. I bet people can find it. Thanks.
Oh, they could definitely find it.
Dara, thank you so much. It's such a fascinating, interesting story, and I hope the Porto community continues to grow and develop and that this film teaches people and about not only its origins, but that the next film fills in some of those gaps.
Yes, exactly. Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be J Screen's Hillary Kenner, explaining why Jewish genetic disease testing is incredibly important today and how to get it. Our playout this morning is a remarkable Yiddish version of Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah, a reinterpretation of rhyming Yiddish, beautiful in a different way from the many other ways we've heard this great piece of music before. It's by Daniel Kahn, a fine klezmer musician. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Gewein an Nigen wie a Sod, wo's David hat gespielt vor Gott, nur dir wo's nicht gewein, als a Yeshua. Und mir singt das Zoi, a Fall, a Soul, a Mische Berech hebt a Kohl, der Duller Melech webt a Halleluja. Deine Munde ist geworden schwach, der Schewe bot sich auf dem Dach, ihr Chäin, die Levone, dein Refuhe. Und sie nimmt dein Guff, sie nimmt dein Kopf, sie schneidet von deiner Haare Zopf und zieht von Mäuel a Robe, Halleluja. Und Heire, ich kenn dein Stil, ich bin geschlafen auf dein Deal, ich hab kein Mal nicht gelebt mit Ersatz nur. Nur ich seh dein Schloss, ich seh dein Form, a Harz ist nicht kein Melichstrom, es ist a kalte und a kalte, ja, Halleluja. Ui, wie am Auto, sag mir eus, was tut sich dort in dein Scheuss, du wusch darfst dich schämen wie a Psule. Gedenk, wie ich hab in dir geruht, wie die Schiene glut in unser Blut und jeder rot im Tod, Halleluja. Mein Gott ist gar nicht da und Liebe soll sein Kolm roh, a Pust der Träume zerbrochen und ne Chule. Sind nicht kein Gewehen in Mitternacht, nicht kein Baldschuwe aufgewacht, nur an Elmte Kolkeure, Halleluja. Napikeures rufst du mich, mit Shem Hawaii läster ich, nur meile, ich der Wart nicht kein Gehule. Nur es brennt sich heiß in jeden Oss, von Aleph Beis gor bis in Sof, die Heilige und Kalle, Halleluja. Halleluja. Das ist alles, es ist nicht kein Sach. Ich mach derweile, was ich mach. Ich komm da wie ein Mensch, nicht kein Schaluje.
Gott schaut's verloren, sei wie sei, will ich verloren, Adonai, und schreien will ich heim, Halleluja, Halleluja, Halleluja.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Halleluja. Arizona.